welcome to another episode of the Catholic Buzz. We're so happy that you're joining us here today as we explore lots of different Catholic topics, and we always appreciate your feedback. Thank you for the recent emails that you've been sending to us to show your appreciation, because we're having fun. And my name is Father Daniele, and I'm always joined by these two fun guys. Josh Sullivan, Hello. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And the man over here who still owes me money from a bet he lost is Matt Van Milligan. Matt, welcome to you
Hello.
Today. Yeah. And how are you guys? Advent has started. Yeah.
Yeah, we're in.
New year B, I believe, right?
Year B.
Yeah. The readings are all going to be revolved around the year B.
Yeah, so we started reading from the Gospel of Mark, which is the shortest gospel, right? So it doesn't really last us all year because it's so short. You know, we have to steal a little bit from the other gospels. But yeah, year B is when we read the Gospel of Mark. And that's what the church, they split it up year A, B, C. That's the 3-year cycle.
Yeah.
We had some nice celebrations for Advent on the weekend, like to begin. Our Advent season.
Lots of them.
Yeah. We did have lots of them.
I felt like I was here a lot. I'm pretty much just going to rent a cot, I think. That's what we're going
to
do.
You are always welcome to stay here on a hard pew. So, Matt, what does the beginning of Advent look like in your family?
Our boys, they're old enough to get it. They're old enough to kind of get into it, or they're just... it's funny, we had a very similar conversation that we had on our last podcast, just like, this is what Advent's about, this is a time of preparation, they're excited for Christmas, so.
For sure.
Yeah.
That it's anticipation.
The anticipation
is what I think kids love. I mean, we love it too. We look forward to Christmas as well.
And... Yeah, we don't want to set those two against each other, just kind of using that excitement about Christmas to kind of, you know, flesh out that this is you know what the season is actually about, and we'll
I don't know if I said it last episode too. We don't sing Christmas carols in my house. I don't allow them until after it's normally after the Feast of Christ the King. And so, but somewhere in there, I eventually just, and they ask me and I say no, and then I just okay fine now you can. But it's between the week of Feast of Christ the King and the first, so we started singing Christmas carols in my house, and then that whole day. Christmas carols.
You regretted it
all day. And I don't mind. No, I don't mind. But they are like, it was blaring loud. Like I was outside working most of the time and I could hear it. And my sons told me that they did that for my benefit so that I could hear it, which is very nice of them to think of me.
So we are moving towards the Christmas season, like you said. So it's a time of year when people are spending their money and making shopping lists and all these things. And so I thought we'd have a little conversation about that, and especially...
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember calendars when I was growing up, always getting, like, you get a penny and you give a nickel at a certain times. I don't know if you ever have that. If you you give a penny for this or you give a nickel for that, and it was like a calendar. Eventually, you built up, like, $20 or something out of all the pennies. And
for you to keep or to give to charity?
To give to charity. There's little calendars and stuff. That's what I remember from, like, growing up in the 80s in the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Well, there are, like, Lenten calendars like that.
No, this was for Advent specifically, I remember. But yeah, it was because we every time we got to give a quarter, a nickel, or whatever it was, we could put a straw in the baby Jesus's crush too at the same time. So it was all the fun stuff.
So we're talking about how people spend their money, and this past week, I don't know if you're a soccer fan, but Diego Maradona died. He's an Argentinian player of soccer, 60 years old. Poor guy. You know, God rest his soul. And I remember as a kid watching him, I think it was the 1990 World Cup, watching Diego Maradona play. And so he dies this week. So an article that came from that was a conversation he had with St. Pope John Paul II.
I read that. And so he says something along the lines of, if you really wanted to help the poor, then why don't you just sell the gold ceilings in the Vatican, right? And then that, because he said that, I guess, and because of who he was as a character, and then he's saying it to the Pope, then it just became news all over. Like, I read a couple articles on that.
Yeah, that was very popular in the news this week. And we don't know how that conversation actually went, but he claims that he did tell Pope John Paul II that he should sell stuff in the Vatican and help the poor. And why we bring that up today is because lots of people have said that. Lots of people say that. Lots of people say the church has lots of money. They should sell their things and
practice what they
preach, practice
what
they preach, and all those things. So let's talk about that today. Let's talk about the riches of the church. Let's talk about your local parish. Let's talk about, should we give money to the church? All those things. And I think, you know, I contribute to my parish. I contribute. You guys do as well. So I think it's good to talk about that, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a common misconception. I think the biggest, talking with people that aren't Catholic, one of the biggest things that they have against the Catholic Church, and not that they have this, but I think it's one of those, okay, well, I'm going to make you guys look bad so that I can alleviate any kind of conversation here or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it is okay, well, when you guys sell all your famous art, then we'll have a conversation about giving to the poor.
And I would like to put that in context, right?
Yeah.
Like, so our church is 2,000 years old,
exactly.
Right? That's 2,000 years of history that the church has collected, and there's artifacts and art and you name it, statues and things. What exactly, my question is always, what exactly is the church supposed to do with that stuff? If not maintain it in a place where people can come freely and be inspired by its beauty, right? Like, well, what are we supposed to do? Let's say, like,
one of the things that, like, off the bat, you'd want to kind of clarify there is the idea of ownership. That that, like, does the church own? Do the stewards of the church own these artifacts? Own all this kind of Renaissance art? These are artifacts of, like, yes, there are the religious paintings that have a sacramental function that, you know, people come from around the world on pilgrimages to kind of encounter, and they're aids to prayer. They're all of these things, but they're not owned in the same way that if you know, I go to a flea market and I buy a painting, I own that painting and I can
Good
sell
point.
That painting and I can use those funds for. But the same way, if you know, a pastor came into a church and, you know, just decided to sell off all of the the sacramental pieces, the people, you know, who are members of that church would kind of rightly be outraged because the pastor isn't the owner. Of those
steward
things.
Would be the right word. Yeah. Like you said, the church doesn't own them.
Yeah.
In the context of possession.
Yeah.
But they're, like, a lot of times, if you look at some of those famous paintings and so, they were commissioned by individuals for God, not for the church so much as for God. And so they're like, okay, I want to make this. I'm giving it to God. And so the stewards, the church being stewards of it, can move it, can display it, can store it, can do that things. But for them to sell it would be like me giving, Matt, here, take care of my cow. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like here, you know, or someone gives me a cow, I'm not around, they give it to you. Hey, give this to Josh. You know, like, this is for Josh, and you take care of it, and you can use the milk from it and all that kind of stuff. But if you were to slaughter it and then give it away to everybody, I'd be a little bit upset. Yeah. Not that God would necessarily, but it's you don't have that right necessarily to do that, right? Yeah. If it's giving to God.
Yeah, and we can make that distinction that to say that, you know, the church doesn't own these things in the way that, you know, standard kind of possession or legal possession. But we can also have a conversation about, should apostolic poverty be a priority of the church? So if you make that initial clarification, there are times in the church's history where kind of people have rightly identified that the church is becoming kind of too ostentatious. There are certain, St. Francis of Assisi is a great example of saying that, like, we need to return to apostolic poverty. We need to return to not just enjoying the, you know, benefits of what would be kind of clericalism or like this this elevated position in society. Same with something like Vatican II. Mm-hmm. You have, like, you're doing away with a lot of the kind of more ostentatious features of the church, so you no longer have the, you know, the papal litter that, you know, the Pope is carried around on and these kinds of things. Unfortunately, one of the major kind of casualties of those types of movements is beauty within the church, is that beauty, aesthetic beauty, is a real aid to worship, is a real aid to centering ourselves in our prayer. Sorry for the rant. Coming from a Reformed tradition, the Reformed tradition developed largely in response to a lot of the maybe excesses of, you know, the church investing in kind of Renaissance art and whatever. So that there was a real kind of reaction from Calvinists, especially, that you're worshiping beauty. You're not worshiping God. You're worshiping beauty. And there was a real attempt to kind of strip all of those elements out of worship. And then, but in effect, that wasn't necessarily a refocusing on worshiping God in a lot of respects. It was, you're starting to worship function, or once you take that beauty out, you're very limited in in the means by which you approach God. And
I totally agree that God deserves our best.
Yeah.
Like when you look at houses of worship, churches around the world, they are houses of God. And mm-hmm. so they should be beautiful. You should walk into a church, like, you know, when we travel and stuff, and you walk into a beautiful church, it takes your breath away. And it really contributes to you raising up your hearts to God and lifting up your prayers, because it's sort of like in this beautiful way shows the immensity of God. I think that's stunning. And you don't get the same feeling when we remove that beauty. And you know, sometimes we're building churches now that look more like, you know,
are more functional than beautiful.
Than beautiful.
Pillars of the Earth was a book that I read that had that. It was a Mason is talking about, and he doesn't have any education, but he's a Mason and he wants to be the great architect of a cathedral. That's one of his whole life goals. And that's one of the things that struck me when I read that part of the book. I mean, it's not necessarily a good Catholic book. There's a lot of Catholic things in it, but normally there's some good Catholic priors and abbots and bad Catholic bishops and stuff. But one of the things is building this Catholic church and saying his whole function is to build this church so that people walk in, because they don't know how to read, they don't know how to write, they don't know how to do anything. But when they walk in, they can see the pictures, they can see the immensity of the building that he created, and know that this house belongs to a great king, the King of Kings, and that kind of, and he goes off on that, a little bit of a tangent. And I always remember reading that part and just going like, oh, that's why when you go into a big church, you normally see right near the front of the church, it normally, right above the altar, goes up. You know, it goes up so high too. Like if I remember going into a cathedral, just walking up and looking up and just realizing like, wow, how high that is. Like stories upon stories upon stories. And you could see directly up. And the idea there too is like, you can't see God, like you just, he's up there. It's just, wow, you know?
Yeah, and I think we have to remember too that God has blessed people with good talents and gifts, and we're returning those gifts and talents to God by using them to honor him, right?
Yeah.
So people with the gifts of building beautiful, architecturally sound buildings, or artists who show the immensity of God. These are beautiful things. For example, I'm assuming both of you have been to the Vatican.
Yes.
Yeah?
No, I've never been.
Oh, road trip.
Yeah, we're going to take Matt.
Yeah. We should go and film an episode of our podcast
right in front
until they kick us out. So, but if you've been to that, which you have, Josh, like it's stunning.
It is.
Like just being outside in the courtyard is like in the street leading up to it. You feel the presence. You feel different being there, right? And then when you walk in and you start to see
it's big, and
underneath the Vatican, there are stories. So the Vatican was sort of built on top over the centuries. It was started here and then kind of built on top and built on top and built on top. So you can, I don't know if it's open to the public, go down these levels. I was at the tomb of St. Peter.
Some of it you can, some of it you have to have special permission.
Yeah, and the saints are buried there.
Yeah.
Like St. Peter, there's the place where St. Peter was died. There's Pope John Paul II is down there.
Yeah.
Like lots of beautiful saints. This place should be a place where we honor God. This place should be a place where we keep that beauty. You know, what would it be if, Josh came in and just took a statue from the Vatican and put it at his house? Now we can't, what do we do with it there?
The other problem that comes with it is, what do you do with that money? Feed the poor, poor? Who, where, when, why, and all that kind of stuff. Not that that's a reason not to do it, but what about the poor? Why not the sick? Should we be healing the sick? So like, if let's say we were to do that, then who gets to decide? Is it just the people of Rome that get that? But these gifts are being given all around the world. Mm-hmm. Or do we have to like, just the logistics of...
And let's not forget that the Catholic Church is the number one contributor to charities in the entire world and has been, I mean, fact check me, but has been probably... forever.
Yeah. There was that was one of the things. Once you make those clarifications, then I think it's safe. If you're having this discussion with someone else, then you can have the discussion. Well, like, the church actually is the most charitable organization in the world. And there was an article published either in Forbes or The Economist, I can't remember because it's probably 6 or 7 years ago, trying to fact check the claim that the way they categorized all of them, that they're saying it's like, okay, well, this aspect of their overall operational budget, it goes to charity, but they recategorized a bunch of things as healthcare, education, a lot of the missional activities of the church, to say that we're like, well, no, these aren't necessarily charitable. So they're trying to fact check that claim. But once you actually come at those facts without any sort of intention to misrepresent, the fact is checked. It is true that
for sure, and that's so. There's a couple structures of the church. So the church, like the Vatican and things like that, they contribute lots. And then you think of like every diocese, right? Every individual diocese that has its own local projects that they contribute to. Then you bring it down even further to the each local parish. Like in our parish right now, we support so many different things. The crisis center, the women's and men's shelters, children in our schools who have no meals.
Like I say, when there's no COVID, you have things like you give out lunches and meals and stuff like that.
We're doing that now.
And food banks.
Supporting parishioners. Look at the giving trees up for Christmas. You know, our parishioners are fantastic and beautiful people who are just giving to people who need. So there's tiers and tiers and tiers of how much the church actually does for society. And I think it's kind of, I think it's kind of awful that people criticize the church for not doing it, because they do. They give so much of their resources. Think of the food banks and the people who are fed and clothed, and that's the mission of the church.
Yeah.
When you talk about a poverty of the church, you talk about St. Francis, you know. Yeah.
When you talk about apostolic poverty too, so that is something like as a priest, and I know this, so I'll say my part, and then you can confirm or deny or whatever. But I would go in and I would help priests with their finances.
You've never offered to do that with me.
I'm sorry, I can't. But I used to do that. I used to do that with all the priests that in the area that I was contributing in Northern Ontario, and so I would talk to them all about how they're saving for retirement, if they're saving for retirement, and I knew what the diocese plan was about retirement, if any, depending on the diocese you're in, all that kind of stuff. But people don't realize priests make almost half of the poverty line. So the poverty line is, I think, at $37,000. A priest makes somewhere between $17,000 to maybe $22,000 or $23,000, depending on the diocese. I'm sure the ones in Toronto make a little bit more than that because the cost of living would be a little bit higher. But like that's around, right? Priests don't get $100,000 a year. And so when I compare that, 8 years of university to a doctor who takes 8 years of university. 8 years of university, they make $300,000 a year, or roughly, right? $150,000 to $300,000 a year for a doctor, 8 years of university, versus a priest who does 8 years of university to make $20,000 a year. And then sometimes, depending on the diocese, sometimes the diocese doesn't even pay for that. So the priest has to pay off half of that or the whole thing. Or, you know, so like giving to our seminarians, contributing to the diocese, but for our seminarians or those types of things to make these priests or train these priests, I should say. There's a whole other part there that people don't realize. When a priest is doing this, he's not doing ministry to get paid, right? And that's just showing the shepherding of from a priest's end of things and then going into the church. So, like, there's a whole other tier there, right, of the ministry that priests offer.
And they didn't tell me the salary until it was too late. So I should have asked. But you're absolutely right. And you raise a good point there that I want to follow up on, because every parish survives on the contributions of its parishioners, right?
Yeah.
And then from that, like you pay, you think of the ministry. We talked about all the charitable things we do, and then you talk about keeping our building up and the
business part
and
this, of things. Yeah, administration.
The administration of the building. Yeah. The parishes have some staff, like a secretary and maintenance staff, and all these different things. So each parish is responsible for that. From that, there is what's called a diocesan administration fee that each parish gives 10%, 12%. whatever it might be, to the diocese, mm-hmm. right? And I like how you brought that up because people often think, I don't want the bishop to get my money. Yeah. I don't want the diocese to have my money. So they find all these creative ways not to have their money go that way. But the money, the money there is used to pay for seminarians who are training to exactly. be priests. You know how much it costs to train a seminarian today?
Same as doctor.
Yeah, it's like $27,000 a year.
Yeah.
A year of for 8 years. That's one student.
Yeah.
You know, and the diocese helps and pays for that. Then, like all the youth ministry work that I do, the diocese supports that. Then we talked about the charitable works the diocese does on its own to support its own broad geographic area, right? Like those are all things that the diocese does. And then, of course, you know, there's some diocesan staff, but it's a good thing. The church is using its money for good. Now, a couple weeks ago, we talked about sexual abuse, right? And the horrible effect it's had on people. People think that the church is using their money to pay for settlements of these yeah. lawsuits. I mean, lots of that is taken from insurance settlements yeah. and all these different things, right? Course, and not from like when people think like you give $20 to your parish, that $20 goes to a lawsuit. I mean, that's yeah. not how it works. Yeah. Your $20 stays in your parish, mm-hmm. right? To support the needs there. So I think that's worth
mentioning. And distinguishing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, and even on top of that is other people that donate or have a like we have, on top of the parishioners and the church itself, when we go back to charity works, you have things like the Knights of Columbus, you have things like the CWL right. and St. Paul's group and St. Francis group and all those types of things that have these outlying reaches into the community. A lot of hospital, like St. Joseph,
yeah.
Mother House, starting like the colleges and all that kind of stuff, as we mentioned before. Like yeah. it's just amazing. But that's all from local too, is being supported and then eventually going out that way.
It's yeah. so true. Yeah.
And a lot of the critique is just how come we don't see the church giving more? How come we don't see? Mm-hmm. All of the things we've cited so far are very visible, you know, examples of charity. But following kind of the biblical mandate, like, no, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Then it's like there's kind of you take away from your charity by, you know, making a public spectacle of it or, yeah. or saying
try to get on the front page. Look at how much we donated to.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the we talked about it when we as a family transitioned over to kind of automatic withdrawals instead of, you know, putting the envelope yeah. in the thing, because one of the things I was concerned about is like that that's an example to my children. There's like me putting something in the basket, it shows like is an example to them that like, no, this is important, this is something that we do as a family, and hopefully they would carry that tradition forward. Because in the going back to the sort of biblical context, like a lot of the charitable work, that there was a commitment like leave the corners of your field unplowed so that the poor can go by their own effort and gather whatever. But like a big part of that was everybody in the community knew how generous you were.
Yeah.
Everyone in the community knew by how much what you took as a
how
corner.
How much land you took off.
Yeah. 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 So there is you know, you want to balance those two things. You want to be a good example of charity to, you know, your family, your community, and the world, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you don't want to be so overt about it that you're kind of, you know...
Yeah, and even as a pastor, like, I know many situations where families will come and ask the church for assistance, and we help them, and, you know, we just kind of say, we've helped people this year. We don't go into details about, like, you know...
Bobby Joe.
Exactly, yeah. came and asked for this and did this. And,
yeah, of course
you not. Know, of course, there's sensitive things that, you know...
On that topic, then, is tithing. Because I know I had the same similar yeah. experience. When we went to that, I was like, I'm not putting something in the basket. And for my kids, but also, actually, I got to be honest with you, part of it was like, people aren't going to think I'm not donating. But I am. Not that I cared so much about that. I had to deal with that myself. But also just like... for my kids to see that you're actually donating. Tithing. There's different ways to tithe. And people, one of the things that I had to do, there was a time where I went on disability and we didn't have a lot of money in my house and everything else. But there's other ways to tithe other than just giving. So people at one time were used to give money in lieu of doing anything else, right? Because they were too busy to do other stuff. So it was like, here, I'll give money to the church and you can feed the poor for me. Right. Because you have this ministry already in place. So here you go. And then that's kind of where tithing came. And that's where indulgences started, when we talk about indulgences, it started kind of forming, was like, here, I'm giving money to the church. You're going to do this good act for me. It's going to get me into heaven. You know what I mean? And then that's kind of where, okay, I can buy my way into heaven if I just keep buying services for the poor. But it's not necessarily, you know, whereas in tithing is giving to the church, whether that be through time, whether through your gifts and talents, but also through money. It's important to give your money. I think that too. But also giving your time. So if you are just sitting in mass and doing nothing, could you read? Could you be an usher? Could you be a Eucharistic minister? Where is some of your gifts and talents? Where do they lie? And so what are the things that bring you joy? Like, are you an administrator? So if you're an administrator, maybe you look at getting on and helping Father out with a pastoral team or something like that, administration type work. Maybe you're the one that's going to organize the lectures, or, you know, like little things like that. So where your gifts and talents lie, and use those and give them back to God through your service. Maybe ushering is a good spot for you to be. And so that's where that you just put your name down. And then, so I encourage people that are wondering how else, like I give money, which is good. You want to give money because you got to keep everything open, the doors, the heat on, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But giving up your time as well, just in service, you know?
Yeah, and I think, like, I always like to tell people that their parish should be like their second home.
Yes,
100%. Right? And I want people.
For some people,
feel
it's more like that than others.
Really, it's like their first home. Yeah, exactly. But people should feel comfortable here. People should make it their home. It is their spiritual home. I love when people just kind of like help themselves around here. You know, like our young people who come in here and just make themselves at home and hang out
while they're waiting for something.
While they're waiting for something. Yeah. That's awesome. The parish church should be like that. My parish church was like that when I was younger, and it should be like that. So with being a second home, we take care of it like our home.
Exactly.
So if, like, there's five, let's say there's you and your wife and your kids in your household, and the two of you, the providers of the house, are providing for the needs of the house. Well, same thing with our second home. There's hundreds of members of this second home, mm-hmm. and if all of us did our part, we can provide for the great needs of mm-hmm. the church that does do so much charitable work and work in the parish and outreach to the community. And more importantly, the number one thing we do in the church is provide for our spiritual life.
Yeah.
You know, and we do that when the community has a part in it. So part of it is, yes, contributing like our gifts and our talents and things, and contributing what God has blessed us with.
Yes.
Right? So for some people, that will be a higher amount. And so for some people, that will be a lower amount. You know, people always ask, how much should I give? It does depend on your situation, you know, but, you know.
It reminds me of right in the gospel of the Pharisee making a big show of giving a big amount of money, and then the widow coming by and giving
the coins.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And saying it's not, it's on what each person is different, right? But knowing that what you're giving is what is giving back to God.
Yeah.
And what you can afford, or what you feel like you can afford to give. There was times where I couldn't, we couldn't give very much. Like I remember putting $5 in the weekend basket, and that's all I could afford. But we were dedicated in helping. So, mm-hmm. you know, boys are altar serving and then like fixing up halls or fixing up the church when we were in Thunder Bay specifically. Mm-hmm. We put a whole hall back together with some of the men there, but like organizing it and getting it done. You know what I mean?
You do what you can to help your second home.
Yeah.
I think it's been a good conversation to have, because the church might have some beauty and some wealth, but, you know, like I think it's used responsibly. I think it's there for us to share in the beauty there. And I think the church does do a fantastic job of supporting its members and the members of the community mm-hmm. at large.
Yeah.
So good. Thanks for this discussion. And if you guys have any questions for us of anything we've talked about today, or suggestions for a future episode, you let us know by emailing us at thecatholicbuzzpodcast@gmail.com. And from the time of this episode till next, I'll be talking to Josh about my personal finances and retirement plan. And in the meantime, we'll keep praying for you, and you keep praying for us in this ministry. For Josh Sullivan and Matt Van Milligan, I'm Father Daniele. We'll see you next time on The Catholic Buzz.